This is The Conversation, episode number 100. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome. Our guest today is Lester Monson. Thank you for being here. We made it. We slogged through. It's been a little over 3 years. So we're talking about, 33 and a third episodes per year, roughly, to get here. There have been weeks where, as if you remember back that far, where there were two episodes in a week, and then there were periods where you had a month and a half or 2 months between episodes. So we're all over the map. We're trying to get down to once a week again, wherever possible, maybe once every other week. That's not too bad either. Would you agree? And yeah, we've got a great episode to mark the 100th episode with Lester Monson, who has a great story and keeps it real the whole time. And that's what makes for a great conversation. We've got Deb Cloudman co-hosting us along the way to make it conversational. This is not the interview. And you may know if you've been listening lately that it's not so word that I don't like to use in applying to these conversations. They're conversations. They're not interviews. Maybe that's semantic, but I think if you wanted to get into it, you find out it's more than semantic. In any case, how long are you going to be talking to us about these semantics? Let's put it this way. If it's lately been 3.5 minutes of an intro, today is going to be 4.5 minutes. All right. So stick around. You're going to learn a lot before we get to learning a lot from Lester. What do I need to tell you? So the show started, I want to just give you a brief history of the show. The show was inspired by WTF, the ultra popular podcast. And if you listen back to some of the early episodes, you will hear a little too much of that tone in some cases, or rather derivative some of the earlier episodes were. But it gradually evolved and has gone through a few different phases, including the Conversation Three-Way, which retains certain elements in that I am using co-hosts for most of the in-person conversations now. And we've come down to a point where there are two categories of conversation podcast. There's the one that I do with an individual exclusively at this point in New York. I'd like to expand that to other cities, but that will happen in due time. And then the other version is the local, that is to the LA area, in-person conversation with myself and a co-host. And I like that format a lot because it provides for more of a conversational rather than interview format. And what else? Let's see. I wanted to use this juncture at the 100th. This is what I also wanted to tell you. How did you come to decide that there are 100 episodes? There were a number of episodes early on that were two-parters. So I made each parter, I counted each two-parter as a single episode. So each guest, whether it was two episodes or one, became one episode. There have been episodes, several episodes that have not run for reasons either of my doing or the guests. And those have been cut down because now guests are sort of forewarned more what they're in for. And so that has happened very little lately, if at all. And what else do I want to tell you? So we got to 100 episodes, not including the ones that might have run briefly and then were taken off, or ones that never ran, and condensing all the two-parters. That's how we got to 100. And hopefully it'll be a lot faster getting to 200. All right. Enough about the numbers. So I wanted to take this opportunity to thank some people who have helped make and keep the show going, starting first and foremost with Jeff Tuck of Notes on Looking, who allowed me to launch the podcast through his platform, the Notes on Looking.com blog, which is still going. Check it out if you're not familiar. Thank you, Jeff, for allowing me to do that. We started with just a figment of our imagination, or sort of an inspiration of other podcasts, and brought it around to Jeff, and he was open to it, and he participated in the very first episode, if you go back into the well with Barry Zipperstein back in the day. So thank you, Jeff. I want to thank Steve Turner, the dealer who just moved to Hollywood, who is probably not listening to this episode and probably not a lot of recent episodes, but he inadvertently provided me with a few of my earliest podcasts He was doing studio open studios. He was promoting, I should say, and organizing open studios with several artists at the time that he was working with. And I went to those open studios, met the artists, and subsequently did podcasts with them. So thank you for that. I want to thank Amir Fala, who has for a long time been a big supporter of the podcast and provided me with the website platform for the show up until recently, when Van Cacinero of Brisbane, Australia, helped me set up the latest one, which you see now. But thanks to Amir for everything, and thanks to Van for helping set this new site up. Thanks to Sharon Loudon, the artist Sharon Loudon, who's been an incredible supporter of the show and has provided me with numerous guests, I think all New York-based, but some of these guests have been some of the best podcasts, including ones with Patty Johnson, Christian Riveros Fonet, and Walter Robinson. And she's probably going to provide me with a few more as we continue. My co-hosts, I want to thank former co-host Margie Schnibbe, current Deb Cloudman, who you'll hear in a bit. And we have a new co-host coming on board, at least intermittently, probably the episode after this one. So stay tuned for that. I don't want to spoil it with a name just yet. Stay tuned. I want to thank everybody who donated during the Kickstarter campaign, which was back about a year and a half ago. It was a real vote of confidence. As modest as it was, we doubled our very modest goal, and it was thanks to people who gave both their artwork to be bid on and people who donated money towards those works, or in some cases, just straight money. So thanks to all of you for doing that. Appreciate it. And I'm probably leaving people out. If I started mentioning names, I would have to mention so many. So I'm just going to thank you in general. And lastly, and I hope I'm not forgetting any people along the way, but I want to thank my assistant / intern, Philip Koshchuk, who met through Samantha Fields. Thank you also, Samantha Fields, for inviting me to Cal State Northridge and for hooking me up with Philip. So Philip has been helping on the social media, and hopefully he is helping me apply for grants currently. And he's just finished applying to grad school. So if you are a admissions person at UCLA or where else did you apply, Philip? A few other schools. Let Philip in, okay? Because I have power in the art world, and I say let Philip in. Speaking of grants, this is going to be the world's shortest fundraising drive. This is a listener-supported podcast, and that means that if you, the listener, donate to the show, we will be supported. If you do not, we will not be supported. So basically, I think what I'm asking for this ultra-short fund drive is a donation of $15. If I get a donation of $15 from, say, 100 of you, 100 of the 1,000 to 2,000 that will listen to this episode, that will serve to support our database home, Podomatic, for the next couple years, which would be great. Basically, that's what I'm looking for funding for, you know, for the database support. Maybe a few odds and ends expenses would be amazing, until we get a grant and or advertising under our belts, which is still in the future because it is such a small niche market that it's hard to get advertising with these kinds of numbers. So $15, go to theconversationpod.com and do the PayPal thing. Would be very much appreciated. I can give you a shout out on the air as you like when you do, no matter how many of you do that. So that's a promise. All right, I think I've covered it. This is the 100th episode, and to 100 or 200 more. For now, we go to Lester Monzon. I hope you enjoy, and I'll talk to you on the back end. Oh, I should say also, thank you very much to you, the listener, especially you regulars, because you silently support this show by listening, creating small dialogues, and the like. Thank you very much for listening, and let's get to that conversation with Lester now. Thank you very much. This is producer Michael here. Just one more thing. The audio on this particular episode, ironically being the 100th, is not perfect. So just know that it is audible. It might be a little fishbowly at times, but it does get better as the episode goes along, and you should be able to hear everything, no problem. It just might not be perfect quality for the whole thing. I recommend highly that you listen on speakers, not on headphones. It makes a big difference. All right, let's get to that episode now. Thanks.
This is the Conversation Live in-person version. And I am joined once again, gratefully, by Deb Cloudman.
Hello.
Hello, Deb. And we are joined by longtime waiting room / on deck guest, Lester Monzon, or Manzan.
Take your pick.
He's giving us very sort of half-assed approving gestures.
Whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay, thank you. Welcome. So, Lester, where do we begin? Well, first of all, when was the last time you were referred to as Lester the Molester? We got to get that out of the way.
Anytime somebody first hears my name, it's what you used to do. You know what I mean? And the funny thing is, when I was a little kid, I would get called that. But nobody knows what molester means. You know what I mean? Did you have this conversation before?
No.
It's just something that you say.
Right.
It just rolls up. So as a little kid, you're just like, ugh. You know what I mean? You cry about it and stuff, but you had no idea.
I'm glad we're not wasting any time getting down into the psychological wounds. I think the thing about the name is that it's become quite uncommon these days. So
I feel like it's going to have a resurgence again, though. It's got this kind of slightly old-fashioned feeling, stately quality to it that some of the youth are getting.
The only times I've ever heard it, it's always some, like, doofus character on Family Guy or some film, or it's always somebody that, you know, gets killed off or somebody gets pooped on or something, you know?
So when we talked briefly before about your family, and for some reason when we were first talking about it, I pictured them being around here, but you're actually from the East Coast.
Originally, yeah, I was born in Brooklyn, lived in Jamaica, Queens, and we're talking about like my childhood, you know, pretty young. And then my mother just pretty much got fed up. I mean, this is the 70s in New York, and it is, I mean, that was like a third world country. You know, I mean, the blackouts, the whole Son of Sam thing. I mean, Jamaica, there's just people that were just lying on the streets that were just dead, you know, buildings on fire, and they just burned. And so where we lived above like a small market, kind of like a liquor store, I guess you would say.
Bodega?
Kind of, you know what I mean? And then we, you know, like instead of a front yard, I remember playing on top of the roof of the building, which is pretty common. You know, because I remember as a kid, I would see like a couple of other kids playing on their roofs over and stuff like that, you know. But my mom just got fed up. The weather was really cold, you know. I mean, it was just Jamaica, Queens is not the best place, you know what I mean. So we kind of just moved. I remember as a little kid seeing a lot of different images, you know, people just passed out with vomit on the subways, people getting chased. You know what I mean? Like my mother would be driving and we just see people being chased, you know. I have no idea. Like there's one thing where I remember there's a big heavy set man running. There's another guy chasing him with like a saw or something. And then there's a woman behind the man with a saw and she's like hitting him with her purse or something. And I remember just as a kid, just turning my head going, but I was really young, you know, I was probably like 6 or 7 and stuff like that. And I think my mom just got fed up.
How old were you when you guys moved?
Probably around 9. You know, my sister's probably around 10. Around that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then we moved out here. We moved to Venice. We lived in Venice for about, it didn't seem that long. Maybe a couple of months. And then from there we went to Downey for about a year and then we moved to Artesia.
Were those all job related moves?
No, not really. I think my mom just wanted like a fresh start.
And this was with your dad as well?
No.
Okay.
It was just my mother, my older sister, who's about a year older, year and a half older than myself. You know, and my mother's English wasn't the best either. So she kind of just, I mean, it was a pretty bold move, you know what I mean, for my mother. So she kind of just moved out. you know, and all basically all her family was back east. And there's some things, I mean, there's a bit of domestic issue, I guess, at the time, which I'm not completely aware of it, or I'm not completely that knowledgeable of it. I mean, it's pretty sensitive for my mother, so I don't like to open those doors for her, you know. And then my relationship with my real father is basically non-existent.
Where is he?
He's in Guatemala.
So is your family Guatemalan?
Yeah.
You're pretty tall for a Guatemalan, aren't you?
Yeah, I know. Sorry. Nobody believes me. I get everything but Guatemalan.
Right, right, right.
You know, I'm either like a Middle Eastern, like Jewish, or like just anything, you know?
We should say that you're probably like 6'1 or 2?
I'm not 6.
Oh.
Yeah, 6. I don't think I'm 6.
I think you're over 6.
Thank you.
Anyway. Right, Deb?
I mean, I know that there's Spanish. I mean, throughout Latin America, you know, there's a lot of Spanish blood.
Did you grow up speaking Spanish in the house?
I did. I kind of lost it, though. I mean, I think growing up, I've always kind of grown up bad neighborhood, surrounded by a nice neighborhood. Went to the school where it was like the economy of the students were kind of mixed, you know. And then my mother did not want me to be in an ESL class. You know, she wanted me to be as Americanized as possible. The outcome of that, though, is that, like, I completely just lost speaking Spanish, you know. And a lot of people kind of make fun of me. A lot of my, you know, family members tend to make fun of me and stuff like that. So I did tend to lose the Spanish side. I didn't really keep up with it.
Does that mean that her English was improving over that period?
It has improved a lot. But it was little by, you know, my sister would help out my mom.
But she was trying to just speak English at home as well.
So no, not really. You know, I mean, it would, little by little, we would help, and my mom and mother would get all frustrated, you know. But her English has gotten a lot better now, though. You know, she's gotten a lot better now. You know, I mean, you know, there's California especially, it's kind of like there's like how many Spanish channels and Spanish radio stations. So they kind of, you know, she kind of tends to stay within the comfortable range of watching Spanish TV shows and stuff.
Sorry to talk over you. What was the draw of California for her? Was there a specific ideal that she had about it?
I think she wanted to get the hell away.
So
from
just
my
as far as possible.
Yeah. Kind of, I mean, she loved her sisters and my grandmother, but I think she just needed to get the hell away.
Let's do 3,000 miles.
Yeah.
Right away. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but she did like the weather, of course. You know.
But it was a bold move.
It is.
Because she didn't have any family.
Yeah. She had, I think, one distant family friend.
And now, it's so funny, Deb and I just found this out before we started talking. She's back on the East Coast in Florida.
In Florida.
So it's like one promised land to the next, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a hell of a lot cheaper there. I mean, my parents got a house out there for, I believe it was 100 grand. Maybe just under 100 grand. I think. So, and we're talking about a 3-bedroom home with like a pool. I mean, not like a fancy neighborhood. It's just a quiet, really quiet neighborhood.
But it is Florida.
It is Florida. Every time I...
Sorry,
every
I had
time
to say
I,
it.
No, I mean, I hate it more than you do. Every time I walk to the... You know, I get out of the airport and I walk and I'm on the Florida land, I just spit on the floor. Fuck this place. You know?
Right.
My mother loves it. She's really close to her sisters. It's a lot... It's cheaper for the relatives in New York to fly out to Florida. It's cheap for my mom to fly out to New York, you know, and it's good. It's good for my mom to be around at this point of her life or the last 15 years. You know what I mean? It's good for her to be around her sisters because she's been separated by them in a sense of living like 20 some odd years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's good for her.
And your mom was born and raised in Guatemala?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just, I think we can't help but envisioning this arc of Guatemala. Deb is smiling because she knows where I'm going with this. Guatemala to New York to Los Angeles, and then you become an abstract painter. And that is like a long way from Guatemala, right?
Yeah, that is.
And now, how does your mom feel about your work?
She loves it.
So she gets it.
She's supportive. I mean, my mother's ridiculously supportive. I could be a serial killer. My mom would be like, oh, but he's a good son. You know?
Right.
But she gets that I'm doing something that I love. And I think she also gets that I'm doing something that's very different. So when she sees it, she's seeing it without any reference of anything else. So she kind of gets the idea that I'm kind of going into an area that's kind of, you know, for me, different. You know, so when she's seeing it, it's nice to see her reactions. You know what I mean? Because she'll see the colors and she'll see the marks and she'll be like, she wouldn't get it. She doesn't understand it, but she really enjoys looking at it.
Does she have it in her home?
There's a couple paintings in her home, yeah. A lot of drawings, that's for sure.
Oh, okay.
Like when I was a kid.
Right, right.
Like, what parent doesn't, you know? So a lot of that stuff, a lot of little art awards and stuff like that.
I mean, I'm thinking that maybe your work is like keeping the Florida, you know, type of decorum out of the house, right?
I can try.
Yeah.
Did that start early for you when you're talking about her having lots of drawings from when you were a kid and art awards? And when did sort of that start?
Yeah, I think when I was really, you know, I think I was different as a kid. I mean, I was very different. I kept to myself.
Different as in different from the other kids?
Yeah, I was picked on a lot. And I mean, I was picked on a lot. Like, my mother almost put me from, you know, wanting to pick me to different schools and stuff like that. And I did see a child psychologist, but I think that was through the schools. Like, right. The school kind of said he needs to see a child psychologist.
So there was this institutional recognition that you were being picked on.
Yeah. And then it's funny because I think about it a lot too. And it was just me not, you know, it was just me being in my head and enjoying it. And then trying to explain to like a teacher or anybody else. And they're just like, what the fuck is this kid talking about? You know?
Well, there's this sort of fear of, I think, kids who aren't engaging with what is perceived as like typical kid behavior.
Yeah.
You know, and a difficulty in knowing how to deal with that sort of within an institution, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was just, I was picked on a lot, you know, I was picked on quite a bit. So even as a kid, I tend to stay by myself. You know, because I knew that I would, whatever I said, I mean, there was a moment where I knew anything I brought up or said in some way, shape, or form, I'm going to get shit on.
Yeah.
You know, so I tend to just stay by myself. Didn't mean I didn't like hang out with any big friends or anything, you know. So I did have a couple of good, you know, childhood friends. And then we would do whatever kids do, play with G.I. Joes and shit.
Makes a really big difference to how. Even just like one other person.
Yeah.
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 But the kids, it sounds like, were drawn to you to pick on you because you were visually acting out these sort of, alternative worlds. And they were
not
like.
Not really alternative worlds. It's just, I think I was just an easy pick. I was a tall kid. I was extremely chubby, you know? So then I had an older sister, like a year and a half older sister. And then I lived with my mother. So there's a lot of this, I think, you know, female loving, caring stuff that I had on top of me. And I didn't really have any of this kind of machismo-ness. You know what I mean? Like a male figure machismo-ness on top of me. So I think,
and they picked that up even if they didn't know?
I think I was just an easy target. Because as soon as somebody picked on me, I just, okay.
You didn't fight back?
Yeah.
Sister ever try to?
She did.
Yeah. That's good.
She beat the shit out of a few people.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, beat the shit out of a few kids. Yeah. I mean, I remember getting picked on. We're living in this apartment place in Downey. And I remember being cuddled up in a corner and these like three kids just beating the shit out of me. And my sister just kind of stormed in like a superhero and beat the shit out of them.
Nice.
You know.
Did that make things ultimately worse over the long run though? Or?
No. I mean, not really.
Okay.
You know.
How old were you? Like, what age range was this?
It's probably like second, third grade, all the way up to about junior high. Yeah. It's not basic around junior high.
It's a tough time to be a shy, sensitive, chubby kid.
Yeah.
And like, yeah.
Yeah.
But if it stopped at junior high, that is also a big benefit.
Yeah, because I think I
because that could have been even worse.
Yeah, I really shot up though in junior high. Well, I mean. I've been wearing a size 13 since I was like 12 years old. You know, like my growth just went, blink, you know, I mean, it really just shot up. So, and I think I just started to, I don't know. I think I wasn't as chubby because, you know, the growth you know? It's like, cause I just started to
stretch you out.
Yeah. Kind of stretched me out, you know? And then I think the other kids started to see me as a little bit more different. And then they knew that a lot of kids got in trouble too for picking on me. You know, I mean, I do remember the, you know, principal in elementary school trying to figure this all out, trying to talk to teachers and stuff like that. And saying, well, why is he continuing to get me easy targets? So there were some, you know, the kids were disciplined, you know, but it was tough, you know, but it really, that kind of really made me be by myself or try to stay, you know, alone for most of the time.
And what, and other than the G.I. Joes, what kind of, are there any noteworthy things that we should be aware of that you were doing alone?
Like, whatever kids do, man.
Right, right, right. No, I mean, I think the subtext is whether you were starting to engage in some kind of, you know, creative.
No, activity. I was always drawing. You know, I mean, I think every kid at some point that, you know, dabbles in drawings, you know, because they.
Comic type drawing or?
Yeah, I think most of it was comic type right. drawings. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? For a time, I really wanted to be a comic book illustrator.
And then in high school, was there kind of good art instruction that you were exposed to or?
Yeah, I actually transferred in the middle of high school and I went to this magnet school. I kind of qualified to go to this Orange County High School of the Arts, which at the time was, now they have, apparently they have their own campus, but at the time, it was at Los Alamitos High School. So I was able to transfer over there, which came from another teacher where I was going to the high school before. And so I got a kind of a nice little boost there with a lot of some bit of art history, but it was really an introduction to your instructors were actual artists that, you know, that talked about painting and, okay. and stretching a canvas over paint. And all of this was very new to me, you know. So it kind of started to open things up that, oh, you know, fuck comic book drawing, you know, let me try this painting shit out, you know?
Yeah.
So it really started to open things up.
That's great. It can make such a big difference to have that influence right at that point too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And where did you end up going to art school? Or you did, we presume.
I did. I actually, after high school, I did about a year and a half at School of Visual Arts. And then I kind of just dropped out. I kind of just gave up.
What happened?
It was just living in New York, and I just didn't have the finances, and it was just too difficult. And at the time, I was staying with my aunt in Richmond Hill, Queens. And it was just a real big struggle financially.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those situations where it was like I didn't really feel much of a, like I was part of the school. Just because I, you know. Because
you were commuting.
Yeah. And it's a long commute. It's like three trains. You know what I mean? And when it snowed, it was a pain in the ass. And then at night, the trains take forever. I did have a couple of, yeah, I did have a friend that was going to NYU at the time. So sometimes I would chill with him and some of his roommates at NYU on the weekends and stuff like that. So it was just difficult. You know, it was really difficult. And I have to be quite honest. I was just really immature. You know, and I don't think I was mature enough to deal with it, you know.
Hmm.
And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is just too difficult. So after that, I kind of moved back home, and I kind of just floundered. I kind of just didn't do much, you know. I laid in bed a lot.
So you weren't motivated to keep making work on your own, right?
Yeah. You know, and I remember thinking to myself, all this shit's just way over my head. You know, so there was real no motivation. But what I did do is I ran into an old instructor of mine from high school, and his name was Greg Pickens, and he was a muralist, and most of the work that he did was in the city of Long Beach. And so he was kind of like, well, you know, you should probably think about going back to school sometime. And so I would kind of like just not listen to it. And then I would still run into him, and then he would talk a little bit about it. And then he started saying, hey, you want to paint with me? He's like, I couldn't pay you much, but I can pay you in supplies and stuff like that. And so I was like, oh yeah, shit, yeah. So I did murals with him. So I did for a while. And at first it was kind of like a couple of days a week, just, you know, helping him out for free for materials. And then little by little, he kept bringing me on for pay, and then he kept paying me more. And then it was almost like a partnership, you know, and we would paint a lot, you know.
Then you have that accountability of another person who's kind of depending on you, which is a way to get out of that kind of a feeling stuck.
And he pretty much pushed me to go back to school because he was just like, you can't do much, you know, because he would teach part time, you know, so he's like, you can't do much just with this, you know, and he's like, you should at least learn the history. And then I would do something. I knew he knew that I was getting bored because I would be painting something and all I cared about was like this 3 feet area. And he's like, dude, move on. Like, move on. This is real. The faster we finish this, the faster we get paid. You know?
This is a preview of what was to come later.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's when I decided to apply to Art Center.
Oh, okay. And so this is where the story reaches its apex.
Yeah. You know.
Did he suggest that, or where did you get the idea?
He suggested just to go to school. Like,
why, Lester, you're struggling financially and you're choosing all of these fancy, expensive schools?
Well, why should I, why can I not go to a school that all these fucking rich kids can go to?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I was going to say, though, when you were talking before about feeling like you were immature at SBA, I mean, you were, what, 18, 19?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody is immature at 18, 19, but if a lot of your fellow students don't have to deal with any of the things that you're dealing with in terms of commute and finances and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a very different experience.
It's a different life.
There's a lot more space for immaturity if you don't have to encounter those factors.
Yeah.
So, Art Center.
So I go to Art Center. And it's basically the exact same thing.
Right.
The difference is I'm on my own and I moved to LA and then and it's basically the exact same thing, except this time it feels almost worse because now I'm working 3 different jobs going to the Art Center with 20 units or credits or whatever the term.
What are you doing other than the mural work?
At that time, I started working part-time at the school, just helping out different teachers. Like teachers said, most of it is just faxing and
administrative stuff.
Yeah, but really quick, you know, I mean, just do this by the end of the week and do this, you know. And then I just did customer service jobs, you know.
Which brings us to, so you're doing, we got to laugh about this for a little while.
No.
I'm glad that this was a foreshadowing moment. You and I have talked about very briefly that you're doing this gig in addition to your art that is customer service, which we can't talk too much about in detail. But what are some of the interesting takeaways or experiences that go along with that?
From working in customer service? Man, you know?
I love the look on your face.
Yeah.
Right now.
You know, this is going to sound so bad, but you really I tend to look at the human race as just disgusting. It's like the human race are just horrible people. They really are. You know? I mean, they really, really are.
So are you dealing then with clients that are coming in and you're having to interface with them?
300 to 400 people a day, yeah. I mean, that's how many people come in.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And they're quick, you know, they're quick transactions.
Is it a print shop type of situation we're talking about? Can we not get more specific? That's fine. Okay.
I can give you a we'll name leave it. Without saying it.
We'll leave it to people's imagination.
It's just funny, I think, and I don't know, because I've only done this here in L.A., so I don't know if it's just the area, you know, I don't know if it's different Midwest or something, you know, but yeah, there's people, you know, they want what they want, and they want it now, and if they don't have it, they're going to kill you, you know?
Well, I think interfacing with people on a customer service basis is definitely where you're going to see a lot of the grosser tendencies. Of humanity.
Yeah.
You know? Because people feel like they're given permission in this moment to be demanding at the expense of everything else.
Yeah.
And it's disheartening how many people actually take that permission and go full force with it.
Yeah, but it's funny because I think it's almost, they almost, you know, I mean, this is the horrible thing about like capitalism. It's like when you consume, it's your birthright to behave any way you want to behave.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And, I mean, there's a few of us have been treated where you're like, people have come up to us and be like, why can't you just tell this person to fuck off? And you're like, well, we can't.
Yeah.
Because then there's human resources and then there's all of this corporate stuff that, you know, that allows, you know, when you get to work with a giant company, they make it so, they create the monster. Yeah. You know what I mean? They create this atmosphere where you can get pooped on. You know, I was talking to this girl a couple of weeks ago and she's a bartender and she was like telling me this horrible story about customer service. And she was like, I just told this guy to fuck off, fuck out. We had the bouncer just throw him out. And I was, and she was like, you can't do that. And I said, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Like, you could just get fired.
Yeah.
You know, but that's kind of the, I mean, and that's with any big giant company. You know, you walk into a clothing store, you walk into anywhere, you know.
If this friend offered you the opportunity to train with her just for the sake of argument, would that be interesting to you?
It probably would, yeah. It probably would.
Would you ask her?
Would I ask her? I don't think.
Will you ask her?
Oh, will I ask her? I don't know. I mean, I've tried to.
I think Deb and I are here to support you in making that decision.
I might, you know. And the thing is, no, you know. The thing is, so it's always kind of weird because they're always, you know, they always want people, especially bartending. It almost seems like they want somebody that's young, or they want like a female. You know what I mean? Like a young, attractive female, or they, if you're a dude, they want you to be extremely handsome, or good looking. You know, unless I'm working at some like dive bar, you know, and it's not that busy or something. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've tried to do, you know, waitering, and I couldn't get hired. I tried in the past to get work at a bar. I just couldn't get hired, you know? And it seems, especially in this town, that people ask for headshots.
With pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Wow. What, in what way have you experienced that?
Oh, just, it's been surprising. I don't have headshots. I mean, this is speaking to my job, but the number of times that I have been asked for them in contexts that I didn't think that it would have anything to do with anything that was on the table or being discussed was interesting.
And it was a local thing, right?
Yeah. Definitely local. Yeah.
Because wow.
Most, you know, bartenders and waiters and stuff like that, they're all actors.
Yeah. Well, especially where we can say you're in Koreatown, which is close to the epicenter of the acting world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, well, you know, we'll see. I mean, and it's always been like a gig. I figured my whole thought was I'll stay with this gig because I hate it so much that it would push my art. You know what I mean? It's a good kind of like fight against, you know what I mean? And I knew what I was getting into. I mean, I went to school, I was 27. I had no, you know. At that time, you know what you're getting into. You know, but this is going to be a difficult life choice. Yeah. You know, but I feel privileged. Definitely. You know, regardless.
Good for you.
You know, I feel like.
I want to go back just for a second. I mean, speaking of privilege, the word privilege remind me of entitlement for some reason, which are two obviously very different things. But I was just curious when you're talking about your customer service experience, if you found different behavior from customers depending on the neighborhood, or if you've I mean, because like if you're putting yourself into a customer service job that is, you know, in certain western, maybe northern western parts of town, you're gonna the odds of you having that kind of experience are probably higher than Artesia or Downey, for example.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to say this. I mean, I don't want to sit here and play the violin. There are some pretty amazing people who I've met as well.
Regulars?
You know, some amazing, generous people as well. But those are far and few between. And those people actually make the job pleasant and make the job that you try to look forward to it. And I try to, like, you know, as soon as I start, I try to keep a positive attitude, you know.
So has the hatred for the job actually propelled you in the studio?
It always does. The plan? I mean, it always does. I hate to use the word hatred for the job, but
distaste.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a good push, you know? It's a good push. It's a good, you know, it's good, you know, putting your fingers through the crap and just digging yourself out. It's a lot of crap you got to dig through, you know?
Yeah.
And it is interesting, you know, and it is, and sometimes people, because I don't really tell people that I'm an artist. People don't really ask you either. You know, they already automatically assume that you're an actor or you have to be playing a band on the weekends or something. You know what I mean? So a lot of them don't. So when they do find out, you do have the weirdest conversations. You know.
Or the most mundane conversations where they ask you maybe what your medium is. And
no, then most of them want to talk about street art.
Oh.
It's the area.
Right, you know what I mean? Right. And so when they find out you're an abstract painter, and that's where things get kind of maybe weird.
Yeah, they kind of it gets a little bit over the heads, or not over that. I think their interest is just like, oh, you know, because they want something a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they want a sticker that they can put on, you know, on their laptop or something.
Right. Right.
You know, you have no
idea. You
should
make Lester stickers. You totally should.
You have no idea how many conversations about who's that guy, Brainwash or Brainstorm?
Right. Oh, that's got to be. Maybe that's the worst part of your job, huh?
Yeah,
having to hear those conversations.
Oh, and that street show that was in downtown a couple years back.
The Jeffrey Deitch curated show. Yeah. Mm hmm.
You should totally see it. No.
So when you, getting back to what Deb was talking about with, you know, the job propelling you to work harder, I was wondering if when you leave the job, you know, if you're more sort of not only motivated, but kind of comfortable working on your paintings than other people might be, because, you know, you hear about artists who are like, it's an ongoing struggle, but I wonder if relative to the grind that you're going through at your job, it's maybe it's more of a respite type of situation.
A bit. I mean, at first it was very much work, 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 try, try, try. Now I'm on it's automatic with me. It's just like a system, you know, that's in my head. I'm working on this painting. I'm working on this one. I don't know what to do with this one. So mostly it's in my head. And it's just I'm working things in my head. You know what I mean? What should I do with it? What should I not do with it? Should I destroy it? Should I not destroy it? Let me look at it for a couple of days while I'm doing this thing over here. You know? I mean, I just kind of just, at this point, it's always just work.
And you have a long process with each piece, too.
Somewhat, sometimes. Yeah. I mean, there are times where a painting can take me a couple of months. And I think that's the stubbornness of me. You know what I mean? Well, I'm not going to do anything else. This little fucker gets fixed. You know what I mean? So I find out this fucker is fixed. I'm going to move on.
And do you do that? Do you focus on one at a time?
Most of the times, yes. I try as much to work on two or three.
Right.
But I tend to like latch onto one object. And that little fucker better get fixed or it should get done. You know what I mean?
So when you destroy them, the ones that don't make it, is that destroying it by painting over it? Is that destroying it?
It's by sanding just sanding it down, readjusting it, and then sanding it down and start over. That's how it usually works. Sometimes it's a process of just sanding and just restarting it and sanding and restarting it. But there are, like, there's a painting right now that I have, and it's just a stain, and it's been just a stain for like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck. And I kind of like the stain, but then I kind of don't. And then I think I can do something with it, but then I don't know if I should put that energy in it.
Yeah.
So I'll probably just end up destroying it. Yeah. But there's another painting that I'm working on.
Serious internal dialogue happening in relation to small objects.
Yeah. And I paint where I work, so it's like I can't get away from it. So even if I'm just chilling and watching a movie or whatever, right, it's still like in the corner of my eye.
So paint right where there. You live. Sorry. Yeah.
That's what he meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have, and how have you come to terms with that reality, or would you do aspire to have a little more separation?
Oh, it's, I guess I've came to terms. I mean, that's all I know. You know,
because it's been a while.
Yeah. I mean, that's all I know. I don't know that lifestyle of.
Are you able to block out the painting in the corner enough? Or is it just
if I turn it over sometimes? If I turn it around, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just so. I mean, I paint literally, I sit on my bed and I have this little dinner tray thing. And so that's my palette in the sense of all the little things of paint, cups of paints are there. And I set that on a chair and the painting's on my lap. And that's how I work. And that's just, that's the way it's always. I don't know anything else. So sometimes I'll do a studio visit. I'll visit somebody and I'm like, fuck, dude, your studio bigger than my fucking apartment, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, it's just the way it's always been. So I'm kind of comfortable, you know? I don't know that. I don't know that. It's like going, you know, when people like wake up and they eat their breakfast and they go to their studio, it's, I mean, it's weird. It's like, I'm going to head to the office. Like, I don't know that. That doesn't, it's alien to me.
But the kitchen is your safe zone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that, you know, the kitchen is my sanding zone, to be honest. That's where I sand.
Okay, so you really are immersed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, this theme of abstraction has come up recently. And so the question is, why abstraction? Now, and I'm sure Dev is going to agree with me, we're going to presume that you've been doing this for a while, and so all of this has kind of grown up around you, maybe without your being aware of it, but, you know, the glut of abstract painting in the marketplace is something you're probably aware of on some level or other. And, you know, so do you feel like, hey, where are all these bandwagon people coming from? You know, is it that kind of thing?
Are you talking about the artist? What do you mean by bandwagon?
Yeah, the artist jumping on the abstraction bandwagon that you've been on, you know, for a long time already.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I try not to think about it, and I try not to have that, because that shit would drive you crazy. I mean, it's just, it's a no-win situation when you start thinking about it.
Yeah.
It does jump in my mind, and it's all it really does is gets me cynical. You know, it gets me angry, it gets me cynical.
What specifically gets you angry and cynical?
Because a lot of these, there are a bunch of young abstract painters, and there are a bunch of people making pretty decent money, and it's not me. That's what gets me cynical.
Right. Of course. It's envy.
You know, you kind of have to, as much as possible, you kind of have to shut it out. And at this point, if I wanted to be more of a commercial abstract artist, I easily could. You know, I could easily do polka dot paintings with gestures that go in because those always sell, you know, and I can do those bigger and I can do the, you know what I mean? So at a certain point, if you want it to be, I think you can find the formula, do it at the size that everybody requests, a color palette that you know sells, then you just do it. It wouldn't be that difficult. You know, I mean, it would be difficult if you know, you just would have no.
Well, you've already, yeah. you've done it, right? But what I'm gathering from the way you're describing it is that you don't need to revisit it. That would be, you know, being the factory line painter that you were kind of alluding to a little bit. Is that a fair description?
You mean done certain things that would fit into that category?
Well, yeah. He mentioned, you know, the polka dot with the gestures, and
done paintings like that, and I think I've only really done three of those.
But those sold well, right? So
those sold. I don't know about well. They
right.
sold.
It's all relative.
I'm not buying a house with those sales. You know what I mean?
Right.
They
right.
sold. But it's kind of like when you get it and when you've done it, for me, it's like, fuck, that was a great solve. Right. You know?
Yeah.
Even if it's so new at the time that I don't understand it, and it might take a little bit to set back, you know? Actually, I think I've done more than three or four. I've probably done like five. But, you know, you kind of step back and you're like, okay, that's it. I need to continually I need to find something else. I need to, you know, I need to challenge my own aesthetic or my own process or my own ideas. That needs to be challenged. And that's the privileged aspect of it. because if I paint for myself, I don't paint for anybody else. I don't do commissions. I don't do any of that. I don't have those conversations. I can care less about that. You know, I do what makes me happy, you know, and then I do what my process or thought thinking is, and then that's it. And I hope people enjoy it, you know, or I hope it, you know, it starts somewhat of a conversation about painting or whatever, you know. I can't work any other way. This is mine, you know, all that bullshit, that's customer service, but this is mine.
Right.
This belongs to me.
Doesn't right.
belong, doesn't matter if you bought it. Doesn't matter if it hangs in museums. I don't care. I mean, I care, but it's mine.
So, and what about the questions around the conversation that you alluded to? What if abstract painting is getting pushed out of the conversation? Is that something that you would be aware of, or is it something that you would try to put your blinders on about?
If the conversation of, sorry, say that.
So, again. In other words, if abstract painting is becoming less relevant every day, is that something that you would be willing to be in tune with as a conversation in a larger dialogue, or would you want to kind of avoid that, being aware of that?
I would like to be aware of it. You know what I mean? I mean, does it seem to you that it's...
I'm just playing devil's advocate, you know? I mean, it, again, as you know, Dev is aware, you know, it's something that has been coming up lately. I mean, when Charlie James talked about it, you know, he's got his own perspective, you know, and it's not one that everybody shares, but other people in reaction to that wanted to know, you know, yeah, what's going on with all this abstraction? You know what I mean?
It's a battlefield so, right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So let's, so that's the conversation we're having.
Okay.
So, yeah. So talk about that battlefield.
I had this conversation with artist David McDonald a few months back, and we're both kind of walking to our cars, and we kind of just stopped at my car. We just had this conversation of us like, fuck, dude, it's a war.
And he's on your side, right?
We're both on each other's sides, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just seems like I think everybody's kind of almost there's a lot of abstract painters that almost look alike, you know, and they're doing exactly the same.
And in fact, if I might quote a Jerry Saltz Vulture piece that you can go look up, and I don't think you're in it, so you're off the hook, but John Bauer is in it. It's this piece basically why abstract paintings all look alike, and he has this kind of slideshow. You saw
the block paintings?
Well, there are several pages. So there's one, you know, there's like five different sets. So there's the black paintings, there's the blue paintings,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
I saw the ones with the black paintings. So it's like all these black paintings of Christopher Wool, John Mayer,
right,
and all
right.
this stuff.
So is that a...
Yeah, and it almost seems... It almost... I don't know how to say this, but there is a bit of a... Why bother to it, you know?
Definitely.
And
it's also very simplistic, to be fair.
Yeah, and it's almost – and I have to be honest, I don't know all these other abstract painters. I really don't.
Do you feel like you should?
God, I don't want to sound like a dick or anything, but I don't know. I don't think so, you know? I mean, they're –
All right, I'm going to let Deb navigate the next few minutes here.
Well, I don't think it's being a dick to say that you don't need to be inundated by imagery and names that you don't think are relevant or going to contribute to the dialogue as you see it and might actually make you feel like you're losing your soul. It's interesting the conversation that's going on around abstraction, because I feel like we get into this zone in general where we get really, really hyper-focused on relevance, like what is relevant right now. And I think part of the reason that dialogue continues to constantly happen is because the art world and the act of making art in general is something we're already always poised to defend. Just the act of art making actually having importance in a society that doesn't necessarily always give it overall general importance. So then I think we get into this idea of relevance and we look at things through something along the lines of a giant, you know, or actually a kind of a small microscope. and we focus on this particular area, and then if anything is falling outside of that area, we start to say that it's becoming irrelevant, even though the dialogue is actually much larger than we give it credit for. Mm-hmm. So I think getting overly invested in what happens to be under the microscope at this particular moment can be a mistake and can be disheartening. So in that sense, I understand not wanting to know, you know, all of those people's names.
Well, I think there's a lot of them just look, I mean, there's a lot of, they tend to, I mean, they look so familiar to each other that, you know, so I kind of feel like, fuck, I've seen this. And then I think there's some of it, you know, and it kind of creeps into my work. I'm guilty of it too. And I'm like, fuck, I'll sand this shit down.
So what creeps into your work? What are you thinking of sort of formally?
I mean, I paint, and when I do paint, you know, I start off with a pattern.
Right.
You know, and then I start to work on the process of staining and mark making and all this stuff. And I start to figure out what goes where. And there's a lot of, you can describe that about a lot of abstract painters right now. You know what I mean? So you're kind of like, so then I have to revert back now and go, okay, I need to make this more challenging for myself, because already I'm seeing it everywhere and I do not want to be bundled up in those, you know? So now I'm trying to break things apart even more and try to kind of, deconstruct things. So what is a painting for me, you know? And now I'm not thinking about a painting. I'm thinking about what are 10 paintings about, you know, how do they relate with each other, you know, and what's the relationship they can make if they do, if they don't, you know? I mean, it's still kind of, I'm still in the process of trying to figure all that stuff out. And sometimes I don't know. And I can be honest, just, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that's okay sometimes.
So then it sounds like you're kind of operating in this balance where you want to be aware enough of what is going on that you are not repeating it or being overtly, but also not being dictated by it, not being in reaction to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I think I was thinking about, you said what Charlie was talking about, and I can't repeat his very articulate and quickly spoken, because he's awesome at speaking quickly, thought process. But some of what he talks about is, you know, the idea that what makes something relevant is its long-term historical importance, like what we're going to look at in relation to this current historical moment and what's going to last over time. And his argument is that narrative is going to be what wins out, because narrative is what tells a story and actually has something conceptual to say, and kind of goes on from that point. So I guess what would be, and I haven't, yeah,
I heard that in art school.
Sure. I mean, it's not necessarily a new argument, but what would be your response to that kind of argument?
Well, I have to be honest. I almost feel almost that it's the same way, because I first off, I've always heard that.
Right.
I've heard it in art school. I've heard it from different painters.
Right.
So it's always been embedded to me. And then I kind of look at, okay, well, who, you know, who's the top painters and blah, 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 or who do I feel are top painters and stuff, you know? And it almost feels like a figure or somebody painting an object or a tree or whatever kind of feels the same. I don't know. For me, that doesn't, it doesn't really matter too much to me, though. I have to be honest. It's not. I mean, it's, tomorrow I might paint a puppy dog and it might look great and it might be the best thing ever. So you never know, you know, it's just whatever feels appropriate to me, you know? So things might change. You know, I was just having a conversation with, you know, Natalie Heron, she's a writer. And then I said, I don't know. Like, what if I just did a portrait amongst these other four abstractions? How she looked at me like, and I was like, I don't know. I just don't know.
Well, that's the thing about painting for yourself,
right? Yeah.
Is that you're, as you said, having the privilege and giving yourself the space and the privilege to be able to make those kinds of decisions. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the nice thing, not being one of those artists that are in high demand, you know? Because I literally have the freedom to do whatever the fuck I want right now.
And creating you were talking about there are a lot of young painters who come out and they're making a lot of money doing kind of lackadaisical abstractions right now and are sort of market darlings and they're not you. But those people are also creating, if you think about it in terms of, I'm going to use a pyramid analogy, but if you think about it in terms of pyramids, they're coming out, they're giving themselves kind of this this tiny little base to work off of with no flexibility to move because they're selling this work for a great deal of money and it all looks a certain way, the same right off the bat. And if you have a chance to, you know, kind of really give yourself breadth in your practice before your work is selling for giant figures, then I think it's easier to maintain that flexibility and freedom within your practice even after it's getting kind of more of the financial rewards.
Well, I think our two cents maybe should be that if you're going to take this approach of being able to do whatever you want to do, you know, and you're getting a little itch of doing a portrait of some kind, you know, because you have this conversation.
You're like, oh, it's happening right now.
It's happening right now. You should see, I got this mirror set up. It's me, puppy in the background.
So this is just a metaphorical portrait we're talking about.
Yeah, it's not an actual
metaphorical
portrait.
Puppy.
It's just, you know, I'm open. And I'm open to whatever I feel is appropriate.
Right.
And if that means something, say like a tree or whatever. And I've done those paintings before, you know, I mean.
But I would just argue that where you're at right now, you know, I'm not saying I'm an expert on your work, but where it seems you are right now, it would take some serious swift kick in the ass of inspiration or challenge or what have you to take you outside of the arena that you're working in.
Yeah, it would.
So let's not jump to any kind of hyperbolic imaginings of puppies or trees, for that matter.
No, well, you know, I guess the talk about figurative paintings are going to last longer than abstract paintings, you know what I mean?
I wouldn't put it that way.
Well, no, but it's that kind of...
Because narrative is a very different word. Yeah, that's all right.
But that, in the sense of narrative painting, etc. To me, personally, it doesn't really... I mean, it's my own world in a studio, and then whatever jumps in, I don't really... You know, if I find it that I want to do it, and I want to make that challenge, and if it's engaging to me, then I'll do it. You know, it does jump in my mind a lot. I mean, it's always in the back of my head, you know. Should I, you know, contrast this monochromatic painting with this type of a painting, you know, to see what happens. And then is it well enough that I should show this, like, in the sense of within the studio visits or something, you know? But I don't know. You know what I mean? It's just, it's never say never, you know?
I think the bigger picture here seems to be that you're, and other... And it's a model for other artists in many cases, particularly abstract painters, I guess, wrestling with being able to be independent and stick to, you know, what they're drawn to and not be, and be, and to sort of reconcile that with being aware of what's going on and not being completely dispirited or, you know, or overly influenced by it.
Yeah.
Which is not to start another big topic, but some of we were talking about art fairs a little bit earlier and some of the criticism of the way that art fairs are currently sort of the engine behind the market, that it's difficult for artists to see what's selling at fairs and not somehow feel compelled to make work that will fit that model.
So. And I don't think, like I said, I think I went to two different fairs, and this is a few years back, and I just said, it's not for me. It's meant for collectors, and it's meant for dealers, and it's meant for growing relationships and all that stuff, and it's not meant for me.
Yeah, but I think the important underlying point of what Deb's saying is that it certainly would be logical to conclude that the glut of abstract painting in the market includes a number of artists who are drawn to that for market reasons.
Yeah.
Thank you for making that connection for me.
No problem.
Sorry to keep going.
No. Yeah. No, we don't want to end it there, but we are definitely close. So
yeah.
Does anybody have anything that they want to put on the table that we haven't put on the table yet?
Are you still doing those little horrible experiences?
Yes. Do you have one?
I have one that's just, it's more of myself.
They've never been called horrible experiences, so thank you for framing it that way. But but that works. If you have one, I'll take whatever you want to call it.
Okay, so my first, group show, right? And
where was this?
This was probably in 2005. And this was at Roberts and Tilton. And I was like, holy shit, this is great. You know what I mean? Like at Roberts and Tilton is the first time showing. And it came through a friend of mine, Maura Meddad, who was, he represented her at the time. And Bennett was like, yeah, you know, show me a disc and whatever. And so he was like, these are great. We're going to do this group show. And I was like, holy shit, yeah. So I... was all excited, handed the work over, everything was going great, and at the opening, and then I had friends coming over, and I was all like, ooh. And then I'm talking to somebody, and behind the person who I'm speaking to, there's this couple, and they're standing in front of my painting, and they're talking to each other, and I can't help but look at what they're doing, right? And the girl points to my painting, looks to the guy that she's with, and mouths to him, God, no. Oh, my God, no.
That's not subtle.
Yeah. But she didn't, say it, but she mouthed it.
Right. And you being the aware person that you are, could not help but sort of catch that, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was literally the gun to the head. Let me give up, and that was it. It made me feel like shit.
Yeah.
Like it was such a horrible experience. And I've seen it at openings before. You know, I've seen people say things, this is disgusting and horrible, whatever. And it was the first time it was literally on me. And I remember feeling so embarrassed. I didn't walk into that gallery to Roberts and Tilton's. I didn't walk into this gallery for 6 months, 8 months.
Yeah.
Like I almost kind of felt embarrassed to see him because my painting was so god awful that he was able to put it, you know what I mean? But he still put it up in his gallery, you know?
So you totally took it in as even more weight his opinion, which was obviously that it was good work. Otherwise,
right.
He wouldn't have
put it
up. But yeah,
I almost felt bad for him that he had to show this painting in his gallery that I wouldn't even walk in there because I was too embarrassed. You know what I mean? But it was it was the first time, I mean, outside of an art center, you know what I mean? It was the first time showing.
Right.
And so then I'm thinking, well, fuck, if this girl thinks it's that bad, who else? I'm looking around and seeing if people are all like, take a picture. And I'm like, okay.
Did you tell him
that
you heard that? The dealer?
No, Bennett, no. I'm sure, if I was to tell him back then, he would have been
Right.
Just shake it off. Who cares?
Right.
You know, and I'm...
Totally.
Yeah.
So now it's something you can look back on and laugh, right?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Good.
At the time, though, it was heartbreaking.
Seriously.
But did it inform... Because I feel like part of what's horrible about those kind of situations, and I feel this way, if people are whispering to each other... Somehow that feels so much worse than if they just say it out loud. It's like, oh, this has, it's so terrible that we're gonna make it a secret. One of the things, and I wonder about that in relation to your attitude when you go into galleries, because one of the things I loved about when you would start visiting the gallery is that you would come in and you would totally tell me what you thought. But you would straight up tell me what you thought, and not in a...
I think that sometimes comes off pretty bad, too, because I've had these conversations with other dealers, and I'm not sitting there trying to, to talk shit or anything, you know what I mean? I mean, there's I'll go over to see Bennett, the Roberts and Tiltons and stuff, and then I'll have a conversation, and every once in a while, I'm trying to remember whose show it was. I can't remember. And I walked in to see these paintings because I found them intriguing and I wasn't quite sure if I liked them or hate them. So I wanted to go see it again. And he looked at me and he's like, "What the hell are you doing here for the second time? I thought you hated this show." And so I was like, well, what makes you think that? And he's like, "Because I can see it in your face." And I was like, "Sorry, I don't mean to give that face. You know, I'm just trying to figure things out for myself."
It's great. I mean, just it's so, because mostly what you have when you have a gallery, you come in and people either are overly effusive. I mean, there are definitely the genuine reactions where people come in and you can tell that they're seeing a show, they're responding to it. And then there's the overly effusive. And then there are the people who are whispering to themselves, you know, and don't. So having somebody come in, and I don't remember what you said to me one of the first times. You said, you were looking at work and you said, it was, I don't remember which show it was.
But it was about the show here?
Yeah, it was about a show. And I've had conversations with you when I've run into you in other spaces too, but you said something like, "I'm not convinced." But you kept looking. You were like, I'm not convinced yet. I'm not sure yet. And I loved that you were, you know, clearly articulating this to me, and also that you were letting it in enough to want to be convinced by it or not. You know, you weren't just dismissing it. Like, I'm not sure. I don't care. I'm not going to engage. It was. So anyways, I was wondering if that early experience might have made you more overt with your engagement, or if that's just kind of natural and how.
I think that's just kind of natural.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
So when you're looking at work, you grimace, you know.
You know, you kind of just, you know. I always feel that I'm not aware enough, you know, and I still feel that there's a big part of me that's completely ignorant. And so it's always trying to make me, I try to be as aware as I can. And I have to be honest, I try as hard as I can. I can only do so much. At a certain point, you kind of have to shut everything out and just do your work.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to, you know, do what I can. That's why I think I just started Instagram maybe 6 months, 7 months ago or whatever. And I make it my business to, like, if I go see a show, I'm going to take a few pictures and put them up. And it just helps me out. It's almost like a filing cabinet for me, for me now, you know, to see the shows that I go up and stuff like that. And it's a good week. Now I don't have to be like, "Oh, I forgot that show." You know, I can at least look it up on my own. But you know, you try the best that you can, you know, and the painting might be great, but if I don't like it, it doesn't mean shit. It just means I personally don't like it, or I disagree with the painting. You know what I mean? And I have to think, all artists, especially painters, think that way about painting. You know what I mean? You should have some kind of a thought or backbone about what you should or shouldn't do for your work. You know, there's been so many conversations. I've had a lot of artists tell me, "If you do them at this size, these are going to fucking sell. If you do them, maybe do four, especially when I did those polka dot paintings in the past, that's all I heard. Make them this size, make them this big, make 12 of them."
Like 18 by 24 or something like that?
No, bigger. Not 18 by 24, probably bigger. Yeah. Like whatever.
48 by 60, magic.
Oh, they were telling you to go big?
Yeah, like the big and then do them. Do like 15 of them or 12 of them or whatever. You know what I mean? And then I was like, that just becomes customer service.
Yes. And I've seen a number of artists do that. And unless the larger size is coming from, it sounds cheesy, but an authentic place.
No, of course. Work,
then it just, it's exactly what you said. Like it sort of kills them. It kills them.
And I've done, you know, I even did a big painting this year, and I had no problem doing it. And I have no problem doing big work at all, you know? I just don't do it. But I probably am going to. I mean, I just have two big panels at home. And it's just going to be another challenge.
Yeah.
But no, go ahead.
I just meant it's different when you're trying to translate something little that already exists into something big just for the sake of. Yeah. You know,
you just don't do it. You just expand the language that you're doing, and that's all it is. I'm not going to make the exact same thing. I figured I'm doing what I'm doing. It's just on a bigger field.
Yeah.
It's got to be hard painting a big painting sitting on your bed, though.
Oh, it's like this on my lap, leaning on the wall.
Okay.
Like that.
So how do you, and then you flip it around? You reach until you get halfway and then you flip it around.
Yeah. It depends what, you know, it depends what it is that I'm doing on it. If it's a pattern or something, it's just,
I think you need to collaborate with an engineer to come up with some kind of device, you know, that's a bed friendly, you know, pedestal or easel.
Yeah.
That spins or something. Yeah.
Those are expensive easels. There are those easels.
Do they exist? Oh, yeah.
They're expensive. They're extremely expensive.
So maybe you just need a customer service it up for one or two paintings.
I mean, I can get an intern to just
come
hold
yours,
it. I can just have an intern to hold the painting for me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lester, thank you for being so honest and for sharing your story with us.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Deb, thank you.
Pretty boring, right?
Oh, thank you.
No, I think we got into it. I think we got into it. Yeah, we'll cut out the boring parts.
Michael's a good editor.
We hope so. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Lester for being a great guest. Thanks to Deb Cloud and Mann. Thank you for listening. The website again is theconversationpod.com, where you can, you know, support the show in a number of ways. Of course, we talked about donating if you would like to support the show because it is a listener-supported show. Again, we're asking for $15 from those of you who have not donated previously. And, of course, there are other ways to support the show. You can share your story through the Don't Call Us page of the website, and you can become a fan on social media, Facebook, Instagram, follow on Twitter. You can also, this is, I think, the last way that I'm going to mention that you can support the show, go onto iTunes, whether or not you use iTunes to listen to podcasts, and subscribe to The Conversation. The Conversation, an artist podcast, is the name that it was when I signed up on iTunes. And it turns out that the analytics gods shine on you when you get a lot of subscribers. Even if you subscribe and then immediately unsubscribe, it still counts as a subscribe. So do that. Get your friends to do it. It takes 10 seconds, and then we will have more analytics chutzpah, if you will. And that will eventually help maybe get us advertising. That would be awesome if it did. Or at least, you know, give us more attention in the analytics of iTunes. All right. Very good. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you next Saturday, hopefully. I appreciate your being here. And let us know what you think at theconversationpod.com. Talk to you soon. Happy 100 Conversation Podcast. Good night and good luck.